Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, and to the Eastern family. We're happy you're with us today, November 30th, last day in November. December coming up, lots of holiday, and we hope that you have a healthy, very, very wonderful Christmas. It's always good to tell stories about Eastern Airlines, and we do that on Thursday at 3 o'clock. And that's every other Thursday. In between, of course, we have the EAL radio show at 8 o'clock every Monday afternoon with a great topic that we do each Monday. So we hope you tune in. We take our stories from the Eastern Files. That's the title of our Thursday broadcast. We take our stories from those that send us material that they want to be on the show, and also from Eastern publications such as Repartee, which is the official magazine of the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, and from books by former Eastern employees. Today's show takes us back to 1996. Actually, that's when it was written, by Captain Bill Malone, a favorite contributor to the magazine of the Pilots Association, the Eastern Pilots Association, known as Repartee. So we're happy to present this story. We try to present this story often because it is a great story, and it's about fate. It's about fate. Even though the title doesn't suggest that, The Compass and the Clock is the title. But first, let's hear an Eastern commercial, and then we'll tell the story of The Compass and the Clock.
It's Sunday in Mexico. The sun floods an arena. The historic duel is on. The sun spotlights a diver at Acapulco. Referees a children's game at the pyramids of Teotihuacan. The sun warms a beautiful mermaid in Puerto Rico and covers the vacation paradise of Miami. Every year, more people choose this one to the sun, because Eastern service is as warm as the destination.
Fly Eastern, number one to the sun.
Okay, let's go to our story, written again by Captain Bill Malone, as appearing in the 1996 Repartee magazine. The big, sleek Boeing 767 was knifing its way across a cold, crystal-clear Canadian sky. At the time, it was the newest and most sophisticated commercial aircraft in service. It could fly higher and more efficiently than any of the older generation of jetliners. The long white contrails following it gave evidence of the power being generated by its two big Pratt & Whitney fan jet engines. Suddenly, without warning, one of the contrails disappeared, then the other. Both engines had quit. Incredibly, the aircraft was out of fuel, and it began its long, fearful glide back to the ground. Technology in aviation has moved ahead at such a rapid pace, everyone involved has been hard-pressed to keep up. Computers perform calculation and store information that formerly was done in the most primitive way, namely by manual means. Radio operators used to type a log of the conversation that took place with the aircraft in flight. Flight crews kept their logs times over geographic checkpoints, along with ground speed of the aircraft, figured on a little circular slide rule invented by Elroy Jeppesen. We call it the Jeppesen computer, the E6B. Fuel consumption was also figured on these little pocket computers, and fuel aboard was measured on the ground by sticking the tanks with a fuel measuring stick. This was used to confirm the reading on the fuel gauge in tile cockpit in the cockpit. Air traffic control centers were providing separation of aircraft aloft using the times reported by the aircraft over the stations. Separation of aircraft aloft using the times reported by the aircraft over the stations they were flying, and checking the flight crew's estimates with their own Jeppesen computers. Seat of the pants calculations also figured in. Harold Howell said, "You knew you were heavy taking off from Atlanta in the DC-4 when you looked up at the water tank in College Park as you passed by." Even more primitive was our means of navigation. Just after World War II, we were still finding our way along the light line, which was a series of rotating light beacons on the ground spaced along the airway. Each flashed an identifying signal with a white light, and then the beacon at the airport was green. The old Adcock radio range gave us an audio beam to fly when you couldn't see the beacons because of bad weather. The volume knobs of our aircraft radios were worn smooth from constant adjustment of the changing volume. Close attention was given to bracking the beam until the aircraft was over the station, indicated by the cone of silence and the marker beacon on the instrument panel lit up. With the advent of both the Boeing 757 flown by Eastern Airlines and the later Boeing 767, a whole new technology was introduced. Eastern's Captain Virgil Tedder, who is now teaching in the Boeing 757 at Minneapolis, says the thing he likes best about the airplane is that pilots were involved in the design of the aircraft, and a lot of thought went into its development. Among its other many attributes, he likes its incredible performance. It has so much power, takes off with a full load from small fields such as Midway Airport in Chicago, and stops quickly when landing. When a compromise was finally reached with the Airline Pilots Association over the use of a two-man crew in the cockpit, certain capabilities required, among which was that the aircraft was to have a flight management system to monitor flight progress. Navigation functions could be programmed into the flight management computer, which is even more accurate than the Omega system that uses radio fixes from ultra-low frequency stations around the world. The flight management computer aligns itself with true north and the Earth's rotation so the pilot knows where he is at all times. The flight path is programmed into the inertial reference unit, which is a navigational device utilizing laser gyros rather than gimbal gyros employed in the inertial navigation system. It is a system used to navigate our spacecraft. It is a piece of equipment with incredible accuracy, so much so that a small error has been built in to preserve secrecy. Another innovation is the ability of the Boeing 757 and 767 to automatically change power. At the altitude where the changeover from indicated airspeed to Mach occurs, the aircraft computer handles the change in engine power. The airplane will level off at cruise altitude and set the cruise power automatically. The auto throttles will operate from takeoff through landing. Another innovation is that instrumentation is by means of the electronic flight instrument system. They sometimes call it the EFIS system, which presents the pilot with an image on the tube comprising the instrument panel. It is powered electrically, but has a standby gyro operated by the ship's battery. The pilot may select what he wants to see. All of the essential flight instruments are consolidated into a single attitude director indicator, glide slope, flight director, instrument landing system, radio altimeter, and fast-slow indicator. For redundancy, three inertial reference units, three instrument landing systems, and three autopilots are provided. In the case of generator failure, engine failure, normal engine starting, or gallery electrical overload, there is an automatic shedding of the electrical load. Electrically operated equipment is turned off automatically. The auxiliary power unit picks up the load when it is turned on. Concept of automation is used for the pneumatic and air conditioning systems, allowing the pilots to concentrate their attention on flying the airplane. Although not high volume, electric hydraulic pumps are available as a backup for engine-driven hydraulic pumps. An alternate landing gear extension pump operates off direct current supplied by the battery. It opens the landing gear doors to the gear so that they will fall free fall. Landing flaps are lowered by an alternate means utilizing an electric pump with power supplied by the APU, the auxiliary power unit. Captain Tedder notes that there is a flip side to all this advanced technology. It is called reversion, and is recognized by NASA as presenting a problem. When a pilot transfers from the Boeing 757, in which many of the functions are automatic, back to the Boeing 727, it is sometimes difficult to adjust to the many basic habits of the earlier aircraft in which these functions were accomplished manually. There comes a time when it is prudent for the pilot to disconnect all the automatic functions and fly the aircraft manually. A case in point would be if you were suddenly notified by air traffic control that you were on a collision course with another aircraft and to descend immediately. The automatic function of the flight management system would initiate the descent smoothly with passenger comfort as the primary consideration, whereas an immediate response is required. Reversion may have played a role in the flight of the 767 over Canada, as they now found themselves in a power-off glide, headed for somewhere on the ground. In his book, Fate is the Hunter, Ernest Gann regards life as a war, an undeclared war against the fate that haunts or hunts men down. There are many expressions which depict the fateful situations in which the aviator sometimes finds himself when there is no foreseeable way out. It could be said that one would have his back to the wall, be deep in the well, between a rock and a hard place, up the creek without a paddle, or up against it. To the aviator, he would be left with nothing but the compass and the clock. How many of us have been down to the compass and the clock Certainly, Captain Olin King and his co-pilot, R.A. Kelly, found themselves in that situation in 1945 as they attempted a landing in bad weather at Florence, South Carolina, following some undisclosed emergency aloft. Fate dealt them a losing hand. Jimmy Goodwin recalls that the DC-3 crashed in a dense swamp about 8 miles northwest of Florence. The fact that all bodies in the passenger cabin were crowded into the front, along with other evidence, indicated that a fire in the cabin may have caused the emergency. Fate was more benevolent earlier with Johnny Keitel, a classmate of Charles Lindbergh at Brooks Field, as he was descending on instruments in the Pitcairn mail wing. He crashed on top of Stone Mountain near Atlanta, climbed out of the wreckage, collected his mail sack, walked down the mountain, and hitched a ride to the Atlanta airport, where he obtained another plane and continued the flight. Johnny Keitel loved stunt flying and frequently put in an air show just before landing with the mail. Fate claimed his life as he was demonstrating the snap roll in the little GB special that he owned. The wing came off and the airplane snap rolled continuously until it struck the ground. Fate was unkind to Captain Bill Cooney and his co-pilot, Kenneth Willingham, as they were flying their DC-4 from New York to Miami in 1947. Jimmy Goodwin also remembers the details of their ill-fated flight. Near Fort Deposit, Maryland, a DC-3 with three members of a Civil Aeronautic Administration accident investigating team were overtaken by the faster DC-4. The weather was clear with unlimited visibility. Shortly after the DC-4 had passed, those in the CAA DC-3 observed the DC-4 go from level flight into a vertical dive. In the ensuing crash, 53 people lost their lives. It was the worst accident in U.S. aviation history at the time. Some speculated that the gust lock may have been actuated in flight, perhaps as the result of a prank, locking the controls, causing the aircraft to enter a climb. This would have prompted the pilot flying to roll the elevator trim tab forward, causing the aircraft to nose over in a dive when the gust lock was disengaged. Even had this occurred, it would seem that two pilots could have made a recovery. A more plausible explanation is contained in Ernest Gann's book, Fate is a Hunter, as he describes his experience in the DC-4 involving a phenomenon known as unporting. Unporting is the balanced destruction of the elevators by aerodynamic force. If enough separation between the fixed and the balanced portion of the elevators occurs, the aircraft will enter a vertical dive or even go beyond the vertical, and no two pilots would be strong enough to overcome that force. Gann had been on a DC-4 flight in which he experienced a strange vibration for which he and his crew were unable to explain. They did not reduce the speed because of a previous experience of engine failure on all four engines when they throttled back. So they continued on to their destination with the power remaining at cruise. For the next leg of the flight, they took an amount of fuel that brought their gross weight, takeoff weight, up to the same weight as the previous flight in which they had more passengers and flew at the same speed. The combination of weight and speed prevented the phenomenon of unporting from taking place. For had Gann not maintained the speed and taken the extra fuel, the aircraft would likely have entered a vertical dive. The whole elevator being loose had caused the vibration. One of the hinge bolts carrying the elevator was missing. Fate had dealt Gann a kinder hand than it had dealt Bill Cooney and Kenneth Willingham. Fate was considerate in 1934 when Captain Al Laney and co-pilot Francis Black encountered a fire in their DC-2, thought to be in the rear baggage compartment. Wisely, Al Laney selected a cotton patch and landed immediately with no casualties. Francis Black got off a hurried emergency message saying, "We are landing. Our tail is burning off." The radio operator on the ground thought he had said, "We are landing to take the mail off." In 1946, the de-icing equipment of the DC-3 was totally inadequate to handle the icing conditions that occurred along the Gulf Coast that winter, and especially between Beaumont and Houston. Fate was charitable to Captain Shelley Charles and me, your editor, as Shelley gave the finest performance of his flying career. He was called upon to reach for all his previous experience in both airplanes and sailplanes to sustain flight with the incredible load of ice that had accumulated all over the aircraft. Climbing in search of the warmer air in the temperature inversion only produced additional ice to an already floundering airplane. Added to the dilemma were the freezing controls. Shelley was able to free them by continually moving the rudders, the elevators, and ailerons. The landing in Houston was a masterpiece of flying skill. As our ice-laden DC-3 wallowed up to the end of the runway, all was not without a price. When we arrived back in Atlanta, Shelley checked into the hospital with a hernia. It was as though he had carried the airplane to Houston on his back. You could say that fate was charitable in the case of Archie Comer, who was flying a Lockheed Electra over Tennessee in bad weather, when the stewardesses came forward to tell him that the floor back in the passenger cabin was caving in and felt hot to the touch. The electrical buses began to transfer automatically back and forth as indicated on the overhead electrical panel in the cockpit. Then suddenly, all electrical power was lost. This presented a dilemma of enormous proportions, as most everything on the Electra was operated by electricity. There was no doubt in the fact that Archie Comer was left with nothing but the compass and the clock. Those of us who are familiar with the event have no doubt in our minds but that he gave one of the finest demonstrations of flying skill known at the time as he completed an approach and safe landing at Nashville. It was later discovered that a strap had become loose from the main electrical bus and fallen across another main bus, creating an arcing that shorted out the entire electrical system. But then, of course, would have landed safely if it could possibly have been done. He is the one who soloed Lindbergh, after all. George Boast won his war against fate when he took off from LaGuardia Field in the Martin 404. Unknown to him and the pilots on the DC-4 that took off just ahead of him, a severe icing condition had settled in over the area. All four engines on the DC-4 suddenly iced up and the airplane crashed on Rikers Island, just north of the airport. George Boast was already airborne before the pilots in the DC-4 were able to report their encounter. The Martin 404 required the use of a device connected to the BMEP, which is brake mean effective power gauge, which would cause an engine falling below a power preset power output setting to auto feather. One of George's engines auto feathered and power on the other dropped to 25%. Later, when describing his ordeal, George Boast said that by this time he was so deep in the well, he had his hand on the landing flap and was preparing to land in Flushing Bay. At the low power output, carburetor heat was not available. As at a last resort, he called upon his ingenuity and used an old airmail pilot trick. He turned the ignition off and back on for the engine that was still running, causing it to backfire and blow the ice out of the carburetor. Then carburetor heat could be applied. The co-pilot reported that the other engine had auto-feathered. George says, "Well, see if you can unfeather it." George told us later that it unfeathered at takeoff power, but it sure sounded good. But then he did not know whether they would fly under the Whitestone Bridge or over it at the time. He and his co-pilot succeeded in climbing out of the icing conditions, but it was an experience they would never forget. Fate pointed its fickle finger at Chuck White, who managed to land his Lockheed Constellation safely on the side of a hill in North Salem, Connecticut, after encountering a mid-air collision. 50 of his passengers survived, but when Chuck went back into the smoldering fuselage to try to free a soldier who was trapped, gasoline that had been leaked from the wreckage exploded, killing both Chuck White and the soldier he was trying to rescue. Fate dealt a low blow to Curtis Fitz and Martin Calloway as they took off from Boston in their Lockheed Electra. They encountered a huge flock of birds that were ingested into the engines. It is thought that the propellers of the two engines on the same side of the airplane went into flat pitch and the engines on the other side surged, causing them to lose control and crash in the bay. Miraculously, the two stewardesses in the rear of the passenger cabin, along with many of the passengers, escaped. Curtis Fitz and Martin Calloway were not so lucky. Fate continued her game as Steve Parkinson came out of the thunderstorm between Washington and Baltimore in the DC-8 inverted. When asked how he knew they were upside down, he replied, "Through the eyebrow windows, we could see the cars driving down the freeway." Together, he and his co-pilot were able to right the airplane. Mel French was well aware of the danger of picking up too much speed in the DC-8. He had often said that the airplane was so clean and streamlined that this could pose a problem. While he was absent from the cockpit using the restroom, they encountered turbulence. The DC-8 entered a vertical dive. Mel French climbed back into the cockpit, hand over hand, and reversed all four engines. Two of the engines were carried away, but the aircraft slowed to the point they were able to pull out of the dive. Their encounter and a later incident over Lake Pontchartrain caused a whole new technique of flying in turbulence to be adopted industry-wide. Mel checked into a hospital so he could not be questioned until he was prepared to answer the FAA's questions. You could say that fate smiled on Tom Mayberry the day he was hijacked to Cuba in his DC-9. Tom was so low on fuel, he literally landed on the fumes in the tanks. From then on, Tom said, "Fill her up. The only time you have too much fuel is when you're on fire." Lee Hines was less fortunate when the hijackers of his airplane shot and killed the Eastern Airlines agent in Houston, and Lee had to continue the flight under such duress. The pilots of the Boeing 767 over Canada, who were completely out of the fuel, were on their prolonged glide from 11,000 feet. In the book Free Fall by William Hoffer, had that Marilyn Mono Hoffer, they described in vivid detail what happened. Well, we're going to have to terminate our program because the story goes on. We'll probably continue it on our next episode of From the Eastern Files. So be with us Thursday, December 14th, when we continue our story and add another one to it. Thanks for listening tonight. Have a very good day.